Good afternoon. So last time we talked about some other things we could do with page tables. So one thing we mentioned is that we could have our page tables control not just whether or not a process can access some physical memory, but what kinds of accesses they can do. And we'll have these extra, what are typically called permission bits, kind of indicating if you're using this page table entry to do an access, should you allow writes, or should you allow accesses in user mode, and so on, which allows the OS to have sort of finer grain control over how programs can use their memory. And we talked about a bunch of applications for this, like if we want to have code shared between programs, but want to be assured that those programs sort of won't accidentally edit the code and break the other one. If we want to do things where we kind of, So then we also talked about something, you know, that I kind of called, you know, page table tricks. So copy and write, and I probably should write down here, and allocate on demand related tricks, where we can, rather than responding to an exception from a page not being accessible by saying, oh, the program screwed up, I'm going to crash it, the OS can do something like, oh, decide, oh, that's not accessible because I haven't copied that page for you yet, or that's not accessible because I haven't loaded that from disk yet. And in this way, it can achieve, or sort of the illusion that the, you know, the memory that is actually allocated with the processor is different than the one the program can access, and make that kind of transparent to the program. So we also talked a bit about creating processes, which we're going to continue today. So we had this fork function that creates a new process, and it does that by copying the current process. So this isn't usually what we think of when we're saying, I want to run a new program, because we're still running the same program. We just have now two instances of it running, two processes. And fork, in fact, returns twice. So the new process starts running the same place the old process was when fork was called. So what if we want to run a different program? So we have a different library call for that, which is exec. And this doesn't make any new processes. It uses the current process. But rather than having the current process keep going with whatever program we're running, it replaces it to make it be running a different program starting at main. So questions about these things we covered last time? So, we'll talk about some logistics stuff. So, this week's lab is using fork and exec in a fork and exec and wait to implement the system function, which runs a shell command. You're going to implement your own version of it using fork, exec, and wait. Next week's lab is going to be immediately after the reading day, since that's when our Wednesday is. And that's the code review for the page table assignment. So as I mentioned in the email, the submission is due just before then because, you know, we just want you to, the purpose of that submission is primarily to make sure that you've actually done things before this code review. This is a limited form of allowed collaboration on assignment that we normally wouldn't allow of you looking at other people's code and other people looking at your code. The primary purpose is to get feedback on sort of code organization and style and things like that. It is not meant to be something where you have two people around you that you can have debug your code. It's not the purpose of it. Or have them write your code. No, also not the purpose. It's for feedback on sort of, is this code readable? Is there things that are redundant? Is it consistent with itself? You know, things like that. The final page table submission is due shortly after and includes some things which won't come up in the code review and therefore we don't require for the second submission, like a README file and something with licenses and talking about deallocation. I would encourage doing those earlier than, you know, the time between the lab and when that submission is due on the Friday. So questions about next week's code review lab? Yes?
During the time next week before the code review, will there be like regular office hours
So the question is, on office hours during the reading days. A couple TAs have office hours during the reading days, but it's pretty limited. I will try to respond to Piazza and things. I probably won't be holding my office hours on the Monday, but there are two TA office hours on the Monday via Discord, and I'll try to respond to Piazza and the like, or hopefully some TAs will. And I have office hours on the Wednesday morning. Other questions on this? Yes. So the groups of three is in lab. In lab, I guess another thing I should note is this means that if you don't attend lab, there's not a submission you can do. If you can't attend lab, you should talk to me about the arrangements to make to handle that. Because you're not going to have a way of getting credit for it otherwise. Other questions? Okay, so somewhat anonymous feedback. So I would really appreciate a formula for calculating the sizes of page tables. So I think this is really getting at a slightly different issue, because in most of the things we've done, we've given the size of page tables. I think there's kind of two things which are related to that that have caused a lot of confusion that we'll talk about. So one has to do with unit conversion. So sometimes we give the size of page tables, but we don't give it in the units you actually care about. So like we tell you the page tables are one page, but that's not actually useful to like figure out how do I index into it, or you know, how do I figure out, you know, how much to allocate for it? Another thing is that often, you want to know the page table size because you really want to know, I have virtual page numbers that are divided into pieces, how big are those pieces? And that's related to the page table size and talking about sort of that, what's that relationship look like? So sort of, I'll have sort of my formulas thinking about a page table. So we have a page table that in total is n bytes. And that's going to be divided into a bunch of entries. So we have e entries in this example. Then we have, I have the wrong e here. I should remember what I wrote on this slide. If our entries, if each entry is e bytes long, so if we have e bytes per entry, then we have n over e entries. And this is just kind of math about how arrays work. If I have an array of 1,000 things, and each of those things is 4 bytes, I need 4,000 bytes for the array. And that's just because the array is one of those things followed by another with nothing in between. And to index into that, we need log base 2 of the number of entries. So the way we can think about that is that I'm going to go from 0, 1, 2, all the way up to n over e. And the number of bits I need to represent, or actually, let's be precise, to n over e minus 1, and the number of bits I need to represent n over e minus 1 is log base 2 of n over e. And we're always going to have our page table size be a power of 2, so this will end up being exact because of that. You see your page table size isn't a power of 2, then pretty much, if you see pretty much any of these byte counts and entry counts, this n, this e, or this n over e aren't powers of 2, then something is wrong. Because we can't make page tables work that way because we can't have the processor index into them efficiently. In the assignment, it's easy to miss, so where we specify the size of page tables, we specify that the page tables are one page in size. And that means that the n, the number of bytes, is 2 to the p of bits. And another thing that I've noticed students have gotten confused by is that if we're thinking of how many bits do we need to index into our page tables, if we have multiple levels, we do this process separately at each level. So we're going to have count how many bits we need to index. That only counts for one level. If we have two or three, we need to do that another time or two. Questions? These relationships. Yes?
Is the log base 2 under E equivalent to the BPN length?
Question, is the log base 2 under E equivalent to the BPN length? Is the length of a virtual page number part? So this is the VPN part. So if we have multiple levels, it's not the whole VPN, it's only part of it. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
When we have like a multi-level page table, can you explain how to divide up the bits into each virtual address?
When we have a multi-level page table, can I explain how to divide up the bits into each virtual address? So I would say there's not multiple virtual addresses, so let's be careful about our terminology. If you're asking how do I divide up the virtual address into the virtual page number parts and the page offset, the scheme is always going to be that we end up with a page offset, and this is based on finding a byte, and then we have some VPN part, which is based on finding an entry. So for finding a byte, this will always be based on how many bytes are in a page, the size of that, and the VPN parts are based on the number of entries. And I guess something which might be a source of confusion is that if we're thinking about a size T, we might not use all the bits of that size T, because when we're indexing, we just run out of things to index when we consider how many levels we have. Yes? Question, is each virtual page number part the same length? So if we look at the formula for computing the size of each virtual page number part, we have N and E. So your question should be, does N and E vary depending on which level we're at? In the assignment, the answer is no, because N is fixed and E is also fixed, right? The page table entries are always 8 bytes. The page tables are always 1 page. And once we've chosen PO bits, the page size is fixed, so that doesn't change. Some real processors do vary this, and typically that means that the page table sizes differ between different levels. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, and some other anonymous feedback. Could we have some started code for the assignments that would make it easier for us to do the coding, as the write-up is sometimes very vague? So it's intentional that we don't supply more than function prototypes, and I don't think the starter code based on those function prototypes is what the student is looking for, because that's not very interesting. Just like a file which has size T, translate size T, and an empty thing. It's not what they're looking for, I'm assuming. So I'm not sure what lack of clarity is looking to be fixed. And if there is something that is actually vague, I want it fixed in the non-example code part, because I don't think it's a good assignment if you need to look at the template code to figure out how it works. Because the template code is not supposed to be what tells you that. Like, it's supposed to maybe could help you, but it's not supposed to be where you find that information. But I don't think the student wants me to like give you a file which is the declaration of translate that just returns a constant and page allocate that does nothing. That's starter code, but it's not gonna resolve any questions about what you need to do for the assignment. Also asking about the quiz over fall break. So there's a quiz that will be assigned on Thursday, and that's due the following Thursday. I don't think this is unreasonable, because we have a full day before and after the break for it. And if I have less quizzes, that means each quiz is worth more, which is going to cause other complaints. And I don't think having a quiz which is like, here's a quiz on three lectures of stuff, is great. Prefer having them be a little more focused than that. But I understand, like, this is a compromise. Maybe I'm not choosing the right place. I prefer to make these choices earlier in the semester so the quiz weights don't change all the time in surprising ways for people worried about how am I doing in the class. Okay. And I have some slides on things in the quiz. I think I'll just mention quiz question two. So in quiz question two, we had a program that could access 6,400 bytes of stuff. We're asking, how big are Earth's page tables? And kind of the best way, as far as being compact, that those page tables could be, is that we had two levels, so we need to have second level page tables. And each of those second level page tables could point to, have each entry point to a page. And we had 32 entries. So this is the, 32 is the number of entries. And we had 64 bytes that the entry could point to, is the page size. So each of those entries could point to 2,040. Each of those second level page tables could represent 2,048 bytes the program could access. And this means that three wouldn't be enough, because if we only had three second level page tables, that would be less than 6,400 bytes. And four would be enough. So we needed four second level page tables. And then we need to remember that, if we have four second level page tables, how does the processor find out which one to use? Well, it depends on the virtual page number's first part, which is looked up in a first level page table. So we need one of those. And even though we aren't having all the entries in that be valid, we still need to allocate the whole page table just in case the program tries to access something that is an invalid entry. The processor needs to find those invalid entries if the program asks for them. So questions on quiz question two or any of the other quiz questions? Yeah.
So why is it 5 times 64 bytes?
Why is it 5 times 64 bytes? So each of these page tables has 32 entries that each take up 2 bytes. So each of them is 64 bytes, and we have 5 of them, which are all the same size. The 4 second level and the 1 first level. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Yes. All right, and I have a slide for what I mentioned earlier, is that page table 2, as mentioned in the email, we will not accept late submissions for that. So please be aware of that. And also, the Code Review Lab, as I mentioned, is in person only. If you can't make it, talk to me. Don't, or you can't or shouldn't make it. Like, if you're sick, yes, don't go. We'll figure something out. But you can't just submit something. Questions or this? Yeah. So the code review is in the lab, yes.
So you just talk to a TA or something?
The TAs will group you in groups of about 3 to do it with other students. Other questions? Yeah.
So the groups are randomly assigned?
So the groups are randomly assigned? Probably not randomly assigned, but you should not, you ideally should have groups with people who you haven't, talked about the assignment with before would be best. But we are not going to try to enforce that. Other logistics questions? Okay. And I guess I forgot the order things. So one thing I wanted to mention for the assignment is that there's a section where you have to choose a license for your software. And As part of that, you choose a license, such as an open source license, or it doesn't have to be, and also explain, have a text file where you describe three licenses you looked at and why you made the choice of the one you chose. The main reason we're doing this in this class is that we want somewhere in the curriculum students who are CS majors to, you know, understand that like code you find online has conditions. This isn't a law class, so we're not going to go into what license provisions are enforceable versus not and things like that. We want you to primarily understand the kind of high-level issue of like, what does the person giving you the code intend to be allowed, what is therefore definitely allowed, and sort of what are the, you know, that there are different kinds of licenses out there that allow different kinds of uses. Yes?
Is there a specific format you want us to follow? Just like...
The question is there a specific format you want us to follow in licenses.txt? No. You just need to fulfill the requirements of sort of comparing three licenses, and the biggest thing I've had people in the past have problems with is this: you need to sort of explain why you chose the one you did. Don't just tell me about three licenses and don't give a reason you chose one. Other questions? Okay. So we were here. Okay, so let's do a little exercise here to refresh ourselves on some process stuff. And we'll talk about IO redirection. So here I'm gonna run the echo command. And what does the echo command do? It prints out its arguments. So in this example, the echo command's arguments are, well, argv0 is echo, which is not gonna print out, and zero. So it's as if we're running the command echo zero on the command line. And this program forks in a loop and then waits in a loop. I'm asking what outputs are possible when we run this. And check with your neighbors if you're reading what. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks the overall answer is A, B, C, D? Okay, so no one for just one of them. So how about E? How about F? How about G? How about H? If there's some other combination? No clue? Okay, a lot of no clues. Okay, so a plurality of the non-no clue answers were E, which is the answer I got. So what's going on here? So we have our main program, and it calls fork twice. And each time it calls fork, fork is returning a value that's zero in the child process and a PID in the parent process. So I'm going to have this little squiggly line here represent our parent process. So we call fork And that makes a child process. And in the child process, PIDs of 0 is equal to 0. So this child process is going to run echo of 0. And we also call fork again. And then we have PIDs of 1 is going to be equal to 0. And that echoes 0 again. And then we do the printing out of 1 in the parent, and then we wait for both of our two child processes, whose PIDs we stored earlier, and then we print out 2. So the question is, well, we have these two programs that are echo 0 that we're running. Question is, when do they print out 0 versus what the parent is printing out? And because they're a separate process, I have it sort of pictured here as if we're doing the first scenario, where they print out 0, then 0, then the parent prints out 1, and then it prints out 2. But they don't actually have to print out 0 right away because they're running separately. They're just running independently, like if you had two terminals and you started two different programs in them, they could run at different speeds. So they could also print out the 0 sometime after the parent process prints out 1. So that gives us B or C. But we do have a restriction that we have in the parent process. We have this call to wait PID. And what this does is it makes sure that that process has actually finished that we're passing as an argument, which is the one we created with fork earlier. So this makes sure that the echo program has exited before we get beyond this point. And we're doing that for both of the two echo programs so that neither of them can still be running after we've finished that loop with wait PIDs. And that means that the 2 has to be printed out after the zeros, which is how we get that D is definitely not possible. That's because the wait PID prevents us from, getting to printing out 2 until after the 0 has been printed out by both echo programs. Questions on how I derive this answer? Yes?
So after the first fork, then does the child fork again?
So the question is, does the child fork again after the first fork? No, and the reason why is because execv doesn't return. So after we call execv, if it returns, it failed. So we're told in the program that it didn't fail. So if it doesn't fail, we're not running the current program anymore in that process ever again. Does that answer your question? Yes?
Is exactly the reason both children do not print 1?
Question is exactly the reason both children do not print 1? Yes. So when execv works, we switch to another program's main and we never go back. So the only way the children could print 1 is if execv fails. So for example, if bin echo didn't exist. Other questions? Yeah.
So with the first line, there's like an array of 2 PIDs, 2 process IDs. So is this starting with 2 processes that have already started?
So the question is, there's this array of 2 process IDs. Is this starting with 2 processes that already started? No. So this array initially is uninitialized, so we better not depend on these values having anything in particular, and we assign them with fork one at a time.
Okay.
So that's how their value. That's the only way their values can be set. Okay. Other questions? Comments? Yeah. When does the parent print things out?
Yeah.
It prints things out in this printf call here, before the for loop with the weights, and the one after. Using printf and fflush. Does that answer your question?
So how is zero being printed twice?
How is zero being printed twice is your question. Okay. So this loop here that calls fork runs twice. So twice we're creating a child process. So, and each of those two child processes prints out zero once. Okay. Other questions? Follow-ups? Yeah.
Is there a reason specifically, like in the quiz and in this example, that we started using fflush? Like, because I haven't really seen it too much.
So the question is, why did I use fflush in this example? So I want to avoid questions of whether printf waits until here to print out 1 and 2, which in some circumstances might be possible. Other questions? Okay, so this is an example. So here we're running, you know, two programs, waiting for them both to finish. And this kind of functionality of running programs and waiting for them to finish, this is like kind of the big thing your command line does. But there's some other things you can do on the command line that we might want to talk about. And so I have kind of a list of them. We're going to talk about the last two of these, especially because it's not obvious how you would do this. So one thing our command line does is when we type ls, it figures out where the ls program is. So we're not going to talk specifically about how that's done, but that's not so complicated. It also supports running programs in the background. So you can run a program and then have a terminal where you can type more commands. That's implemented by essentially not waiting. If you wait, you're running it in the foreground, right? You're waiting for it to finish. If you don't wait, it runs in the background. So you kind of, the shell kind of gets that for free. You know, it has to do less work, kind of, to run a program in the background. Shells also support redirection. So I can run a program, and rather than having it send its output to the terminal, I can have it send its output to a text file. And I can also run a program, and rather than having it read its input, from my terminal, I can have it read it from a text file. And another thing I can do to change my program's output is I can run two programs and have one send output to the other without having kind of me having to like manually copy the output from one to the other. Just have that be set up by my command line program. So we're going to talk about what is the API or shell implementation is using to implement this functionality. So before we do that, any questions on sort of what I'm talking about these commands doing is? Okay, so to talk about redirection, we need to talk about what are files? How are they represented in programs? And on a Unix-like system like Linux, we can kind of say that every process has some kind of struct that the kernel's keeping track of. And inside it, there's an array of what the POSIX documentation, the standard that Unix systems try to follow, calls open file descriptions. And when programs want to read or write a file, they're going to use what is called a file descriptor, which is just an index into this array. And when I'm talking about files, I don't just mean files on disk. For the purpose of Unix system, files include the terminal, sockets, regular files, something special we'll talk about called pipes, and a bunch of other things. So this is kind of what the system does inside the kernel, and also it's something that things like fopen, printf, and so on are implemented on top of. So the system calls use these file descriptors, these array indices. But if you're using something like printf or fprintf, you're using file stars, which are kind of wrappers for these indices and have some other bookkeeping going on. And you might say, oh, if these are indices, what does it mean for my program to have a particular input or output? How does that work? And there's just a convention that the people making Unix have defined saying that file descriptor index 0, that's standard input. Index 1 is standard output. Index 2 is standard error. And if you don't like memorizing the numbers, the header file unistandard.h has a pound define for each of those. So that's how a program knows, where do I read my input from? I just use index 0. Just that's the convention. That's what you do. And this is going to create a problem where you say, wait a moment, if we use index 0, how do we make sure index 0 refers to what we want it to refer to if we're running a program? And we'll talk about that in a bit. So as far as getting file descriptors, this is done by many sort of library calls, which typically map directly to system calls, like open is the most obvious one. That's on Unix, that's the sort of the system call wrapper that just opens a file on disk. There's also things that you've used that kind of are other ways of getting file descriptors. So in the signals lab, use shm open. That returns a file descriptor, an index into this array. But it works a little differently than open, since it only works for shared memory objects. You may have used socket in CSO1 to make a socket, and that returns a file descriptor when you call it. And there's some other calls that will do that too. And all these kind of map to system calls that are going to change that array and add something to it, and then return the index at which that array was modified. So the other thing that happens with file descriptors that I want to talk about briefly, because it's important to understand what close does. And so close, intuitively, you say, oh, it means I'm stopping accessing the file. So that's not quite what it does with file descriptors. So it doesn't do what many people think of closing. So closing deallocates the index in your list of open file descriptions. So it just makes that index not work. But sometimes we'll have two pointers to the same open file description. So one example is, let's say I fork will actually have pointers to the same open file description. Closing one doesn't close the other, because the close operation just clears that array index. It doesn't actually directly deallocate resources. They're just deallocated basically by garbage collection. Just kind of like in Java, if you no longer have references to an object, with open files, if no one has a file descriptor that refers to that file anymore, then its resources are deallocated. Otherwise, it's still around. And close just kind of zeros out the pointer to it, like sets it to null. So with that in mind, let's look at sort of what happens in our kind of redirection case. And the key way we're going to make this work is that exec doesn't change that list of file of open files, and fork copies the list, and it copies the list in not a deep copy way. So if I fork, both my parent and child process are pointing to the same thing for index 0 in their list of open files in index 1. They both have pointers to the exact same open file description. And when we're doing this redirection idea, if I want to make sure my child process outputs somewhere else, what I'm going to do is somehow I want to reassign index 1 for standard out to point to a different open file description. And that's not going to affect the parent because the parent still is going to point to the old one, so it can still output to the terminal normally. So kind of the pattern you'll end up using for this, typically, is that we'll call fork, and in the child process, we'll do some work to open new files and change where standard out, standard in, or whatever else we want to change goes. And the parent, we'll just wait for the child to finish doing its work most of the time. And if we make these changes before we exec a new program, because exec doesn't change what files are open, that new program will have that standard in and standard out that we just set up. Some questions? So a step we're missing here is that I can open files, but when I open files, that assigns a new file descriptor, a new array index. I need some way of replacing my standard out that previously pointed here to make it point here. And that's not something open's going to do for us. You'd be really disappointed if opening a file made it so you couldn't print to the terminal anymore. So that's not how open works. So we're going to need some other call to do that. And on Linux, that call is called dupe2. So we have a system call wrapper for dupe2. And it basically does, so this dupe2 call here does basically this assignment in the kernel. So we have our, what I'll call the old and the new. So this makes the new index point to the old, where the old index pointed. Some questions on what this is. So we're just making a new pointer. That's just a cop. We're just copying the pointer. We're not opening a file again. And how we'll use this is that when we want to implement this redirection operation, we're going to open output.txt. That's going to give us a new file descriptor, one that's not used for anything. And then we'll use this dupe2 operation to make that number one. And often, we'll just overwrite what was previously index one. That's fine. The OS will handle garbage collection if needed, you know, and that will just work. So an example of what we can doing this sort of in a single process is here I make sure that printf has printed out everything to standard out. Then I open a new file called output.txt. Get a file descriptor for it. I make it so standard out points to that new file. Then I can close that file descriptor. You might say, wait, doesn't that make standard out not work? Doesn't. So what's happening here is that if we think of our table, our open file table, we have index one initially points to the terminal. And then we get an index of FD that points to our output.txt. Then doing this dupe2 operation here, I'll do this in color, dupe2 operation here is going to make it so now our open file table entry for one points to output.txt and the one for FD also points to output.txt. So we just copy where it points to. Then, when we do this close operation, what the close operation does is it just makes FD, instead of pointing to output.txt, it makes it point to null. But it doesn't change where one points. So we end up with file descriptor one, which is standard out, pointing to output.txt. And that means that in this example, when this printf here goes to output.txt, because we change where standard out goes. So questions, yes?
So like the dupe2 line, instead of
This question is, could I have put just one instead of stdout file no? Yes. So I could have absolutely also have written, you know, this as one. Standard out file no is just the constant one. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, if I wanted to switch back to the terminal, would I have to get something to say where the terminal was to do two back? Yes. So a way I could do that with dupe two is, let's say I know I'm not using file descriptor number 99. I could do something like call dupe two standard out file no, comma 99. And that would make it so we have a 99 that points to the terminal at that point, because that's where we're at we're in this red diagram here. So we could make 99 point to the terminal by doing that. And then we could use that 99 to point back. So I'd have to know that 99 wasn't in use to do that. And you might say, how would I do that? Or like, shouldn't, how would I, you know, you could keep careful track, but more likely, what you'd use is you'd use a call that we're not going to test on called dupe. So you can do called dupe. Say, I guess we'll do one, for example, and which is standard out file no. If you call dupe, it makes a new file descriptor like that 99, but it makes one that's free and gives you that new pointer to the same open file. Does that answer your question? So that dupe is a call related to dupe 2 that's meant to help with exactly the problem he mentioned of, what if I want to save the terminal for later somewhere else? It's a way you can do that. It can, by allocating another slot in that open file table. Other questions? And so, like, if we want to think about what does sort of these operations do, like, not be confused about dupe 2, is like, I'd say open is like going to assign an element in this array to point to something. Dupe 2 copies the pointer. Close basically sets the pointer to null. And fork is just going to copy all the pointers. So let's do a little exercise here with dupe 2. And I should mention the write call. This is write to a file descriptor these bytes, and then the third argument is the number of bytes to write. So in this example, we're only writing one byte at a time, so that's just going to be one character. Who'd like some more time? Okay, several people. Okay, who would like some more time? You have a question over there? What is the... What is...
Yeah, in the red.
In the red. Oh, what is this?
Yeah.
That's me preparing to explain the answer.
Okay, thank you.
So we'll talk about it when I start explaining the answer. So who thinks the answer should be A? How about B? Okay, C, D, E, no clue. Okay, so have a plurality have the answer B, which is what I got. So briefly, the way I track this is I keep track of what does our table look like, and I have my indices into the table, so I have the index for standard out, the index for FD, and the index 100. And initially, after this open call, standard out points to the terminal, or whatever your output started as, FD points to output.txt, and 100 doesn't point to anything. Then we're gonna write A to our output file, so I'll just accumulate that we have an A. And then we do this first stoop to, which is gonna change 100 to point to our standard out points. So 100 is going to now point to the terminal as a result of this first dupe to call. Then we have our second dupe to call, which is going to change standard out. And it's going to make standard out point where FD points. So FD points to output.txt, so that's going to make standard out point to output.txt. Then we write to standard out, and I have to look at where does standard out point now? It points to output.txt, so I'm going to have B written to output.txt. Then we write C to FD. I look at where does FD point? Oh, it points to output.txt, according to my bookkeeping. So we'll have C written there. Then we have a close of FD here. So there's 3. That's going to make FD point to null, but it doesn't change where standard out points. Just changes FD. And then we write to standard out D, and I look where standard out points. It points to output.txt, so I add that to my accumulated output. Then we write to 100. 100 points to the terminal, that's not output.txt, so it's not part of the output I write down. Some questions, how I did this problem? Yes? What happens if I try to write to null? If you check the return value of the write, it will tell you it failed. And this is a reason to check the return values of things like writes. Yeah? The question is, does it crash? No, write just returns -1. And if you check error no, it will tell you that it wasn't a valid file descriptor. Other questions? Okay, so we talked about redirection, and that answered how the question of one of our commands, or where did I put here? Answer the question of how we dealt with redirection, but we have this other feature that shell support that you may or may not have used, where we can take one program and make its output automatically go to another program. Now, a possible way you could imagine implementing this is we could have the output first be written to a temporary file, and then we feed that temporary file into the other program. But this is kind of inconvenient because we need to manage that temporary file, and we really like this to work as one program produces output, the other reads it right away. And regular files don't really let us do that. So Unix systems support a special type of file meant to help us with that called a pipe. So a pipe is a file which has two ends. We write bytes in one end, and we can read them from the other. And we can read them exactly once. And basically, there's some small amount of storage to store bytes that have been written but not yet read. And this is intended for sending stuff from one process to another. And they're created with the pipe library call. So the pipe library call takes an array of two file descriptors, and it's going to allocate two file descriptors, one of which will be the read end, the other of which will be the write end. And the idea is we can use write or other operations that write to a file descriptor to write to the write end, and then we can read from the read end things that were written. So questions on what the pipe function is doing. So this is going to fill in two entries in our file descriptor table. So as I have things written here, this actually isn't very useful because, you know, it looks like we can only send stuff to ourselves. Why wouldn't we just put it like in an array? You know, also, it's going to turn out that we can only have so much written out before write's going to hang, waiting for someone to read the data. So what would be the typical use of this? Typically, we'd set things up so a different program is writing than the program that's reading, a different process at least. So how can we do that? Well, we could combine this with fork. So for example, here's a command you could run in your shell. ls with -1, send the output of that to the grep command looking for foo. So what this does is it runs ls -1, which prints out a list of files, one per line. And then the grep command looks at its input and searches for foo in its input and prints out any lines that match. So the effect of this total command would be that we'd print out all the files in the current directory which have foo in their name. And to implement that, what I'm doing here is I'm creating a pipe, and I'm assigning the right end of the pipe to the ls command standard out. So when the ls is outputting things, it doesn't output them to the terminal anymore. It now outputs them to this pipe, which means that someone reading from the read end of the pipe can read the things ls outputs right away. And also it means that if ls goes faster than the program it's writing to, ls will be paused trying to write until that program catches up. Then we fork again to create a child to run grep. And in this, for grep, rather than making it standard in come from the terminal, we're not going to type input to grep. We make it come from that pipe. So grep is now, instead of reading lines that we're typing at the terminal, it's reading lines that LS is printing out. So we do that. And also, I do some work if I close file descriptors I no longer need. So when I have entries in that open file table that now point to things I don't care about that entry anymore, I just make them point to null. So I don't waste resources. Questions on this example code here? Yes?
So how does grep actually, so we have the arguments as grep foo and grep null, how is it actually reading from standard?
The question is, how does grep know to read from standard in, given that I haven't said anything on the arguments? So if you read the manual page for grep, you'll find out that the default file it reads from is standard in the terminal. So if you've used grep before, you might know that you can also tell grep to read from specific files by supplying more command line arguments. We're just not doing that here. Other questions? Yes. So the question is, do I need a wait PID? So this will work. So I don't want a wait PID anywhere in here because I want LS to be running while grep is running. You know, I can't. The pipe doesn't have infinite storage, so I can't run LS and then run grep. I need to have them both running at the same time. Now, probably, we want to have a wait PID down here if we're implementing a shell, because we don't want to print out a new prompt until this is done. Does that answer your question? Yes?
How does grep decide when LS is done writing?
The question is, how does grep know when LS is done writing? So when LS closes the pipe and there's no right end of the pipe that's open, then reading from the read end of the pipe will read end of file. Just like if you were reading from a regular file and you ask, am I at the end of file? So this is another reason why we need to actually be careful about making sure we don't have extra pointers to the right end of the pipe. Because if we did, that would prevent grep from getting the indicator that it's end of file. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Yes. So the question is, for this to work, they have to be running at the same time. How does that work given that the OS, we know, can decide to run things at different times? So the way a pipe works is that it has a certain amount of storage. So if you try to write things to a pipe and it's full, your write's not going to fail, it's going to hang. And while that write's hanging, the OS can't keep running you, so hopefully it will run the thing that's reading from the pipe. Because it doesn't have other choices. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So is that generates a hand exception, or is it just I'm running a timer, it's gone off because the write has just kept running?
So the question is, I mentioned that pipes can get full and that causes writes to hang until the pipe is not full anymore. Does this generate an exception or something? So it's kind of more probably a good analogy is if you think of what happens when you're writing, if you did a little socket stuff in CS01, if you're writing to a socket and the network can't keep up, the OS will slow you down. And the same thing is true where the OS will slow you down for the other program that's reading. At some point it will say, I'm not going to let you keep going. I'm not going to keep track of 100 megabytes of stuff. I'm going to wait until the program consumes some of that so I don't waste all my memory. As for the mechanism for doing that, the OS knows when the other program reads, so it can use that to control when it lets you keep running. Other questions, comments? Some people look confused, I think. Hopefully not. So kind of a diagram of what's going on here is that we have our pipe here. call in the parent, and let's say that, you know, that's going to allocate two new file descriptors. So let's say those are indexes 3 and 4. Then in the first child, we reassign standard out to point the same place 4 pointed. And then we close 3 and 4, so we don't have extra pointers to open file descriptions. In the second child, we reassign 3 to point where standard in pointed. Reassign standard in to point where 3 pointed. Then we close 3 and 4, so we don't have extra pointers to open files. Then we run ls and grep, respectively. And in the parent, we close 3 and 4, so we aren't left with any other pointers to the pipe, so the pipe will be cleaned up properly when everything is done. Yes?
So when you close 3 and 4 in the parent before the child processes are done?
So the question is, can I close 3 and 4 in the parent even before the child processes are done? Yes. So the reason why is that, remember, what close does is, where did I have that slide? Is close is just setting an entry in your process's array of file descriptors to null. So it doesn't affect the other process's array of file descriptors, so therefore it's fine. You've already have an extra pointer to that that you're not changing, so it's okay. So it would be a problem if we tried to close like here or here, because when we forked, we would no longer have a pointer to copy. But doing it afterwards, we've already copied the pointer. That pointer is safely away in those child processes. Changing whether we have that pointer still, which is what all close will do, is not going to make it so the pipe doesn't work anymore. Other questions, comments? So I have our summary slide. Okay, so that's all I have. We'll probably do a little sort of review of last time on Thursday, but that's all I have for the Unix API, and that's going to also prepare you for the homework that is after the page table homework, is doing some stuff with pipe. So next time, we're going to talk about caches. And as we mentioned early in the semester, if we're thinking of like space on a processor, caches are a lot of it. So we're going to talk about hardware, and you know, this old processor here, still typical today. You know, this is actually most of the kind of footprint of a processor is devoted to this sort of specialized storage. We'll talk about how that works and why we want it.